So the question is, how, what did Passover look like before the Haggadah was written down? And how did Jews view this holiday? Well, to understand this question, we need to know a little bit more about Second Temple Judaism. In the Second Temple period, which starts in around 515 BCE, I wish I had a blackboard here, the first temple is destroyed in 587, oh, I have to stay near the mic, in 587 by the Babylonians, and we're working down towards the year zero. And in 587, the Jews living in the land of Israel are exiled to Babylonia. This is the exilic period. And in 539, the Persians conquer the Babylonians. And they're the first religious, they're the first empire to advocate for religious freedom. They say you can go back, Judeans who are in exile, you can go back and rebuild the Second Temple. This is a process that has stops and starts and isn't very smooth. And the Second Temple is completed in 515 BCE. So that's the beginning of the Second Temple period. But at this time, Jews start spreading out all over the world. First of all, there were many Jews who stayed in Babylonia. These are the ancestors of those figures that you see, many of them at least, in the Babylonian Talmud. And the Babylonian Jewish community becomes the Persian community. And those Jews stay, most of them, in Babylonia, in Persia, until the 1970s. The Persian Jewish community is the most ancient Jewish community that we have, that stay in one place with their own very specific traditions and customs. And Jews are also going all over the Persian world. Some end up settling in Italy or in Syria in the city of Antioch. And later, when Alexander the Great conquers the Persians in 334, he founds the city of Alexandria in Egypt. Jews settle there. So over the course of the beginning of the Second Temple period, Jews are populating the entire known world. And by the middle of the Second Temple period, by around 200 BCE, there are more Jews living outside of the land of Israel than inside of the land of Israel. And by the first century BCE, the Roman historian Strabo, some of you may have heard me say this yesterday, so forgive me if you're hearing this twice, but this is a very telling statement. Strabo says, wherever you go in the Roman world, you will find a synagogue. That's in the first century BCE. So in order to understand what Passover is in the Second Temple period, we have to understand what are the common identifying markers of being a Jew in the Second Temple period. And that brings me to the big three. What are the big three identifying markers of Judaism in the Second Temple period? This is before the rabbis come onto the scene after the Second Temple is destroyed. What are those big identifying markers? Sabbath and the holidays. Circumcision, and anybody know the third? Names. Interesting, but many Jews did have Greek names, even in the Talmud. Dietary law. Those are the big markers. If you were living anywhere in the world, people would know that you identified as a Jew if you kept those big three. Dietary law, circumcision, Sabbath slash holidays. So observing the holidays and the Sabbath was a major component of identifying yourself as a Jew. There are other commandments that were being developed at this time, even though the Mishnah had not been written down, but different Jewish communities kept those to varying degrees. For example, the whole world of purity, of going into the mikvah, of making sure that you don't come into contact with things that would make you impure, that for the community living at Qumran, the Dead Sea, you know, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that was very foundational to their lives as pious Jews. Perhaps it was less foundational to Jews living in Jerusalem, or even more less foundational to those Jews living in the diaspora. Do you see the source sheet? Okay. All right. So we have this rubric in which dietary law, circumcision, and Shabbat slash holidays are absolutely foundational to Jewish identity. But Passover really stands out among Shabbat and the holidays. There seems to be a specific association between Passover and anxiety about Gentiles. And this is what we see over and over and over. Jews have an anxiety in the Second Temple period about Passover. The earliest texts that we have about Passover associate the celebration of Passover was staying away from the profane practices of the Gentiles, staying away from idolatry, staying away from whatever practices they have culturally, from intermarriage. And because Passover is really fundamentally associated with we're not like the Egyptians or the other foreign nations, there arises this anxiety about Passover in a way that you don't see associated with Shavuot or Sukkot or Shabbat. So I want to take you through some of those sources, and I want to show you, first of all, that Passover is celebrated really at the moment that we start using the term Judaism and Jews in the beginning of the Second Temple period. Passover is celebrated. We have papyri evidence, not just scriptural evidence, that starting really in the 5th, 6th century, Passover is being celebrated. Remember, there's no Haggadah. There's no allusion to a Seder. But there's something. Let's see what there is. Okay, so the earliest source that we have for the nation of Israelites celebrating Passover comes from 2 Kings. This is the end of the 7th century BCE, so about 4 or 5 decades before the Babylonian exile. And we have a king of Judah named Yoshiyahu, Josiah. Now, this is the 600s. So in the 7th century BCE, Babylonia is on the rise. And anybody know what was the reigning power before Babylonia?
Assyria.
Yes, Assyria. So Assyria in 722 BCE had exiled the northern kingdom. That's the 10 lost tribes. We have no idea what happened to them. They are gone. Everyone that we know of who's a Jew now descends from the southern Judean kingdom. Those two tribes. Okay. So Judah and Benjamin. Okay. So in 722, Assyria exiles the northern kingdom. And then, as we know, in 587, Babylonia exiles the southern kingdom. But in the 5 or 6 decades before the destruction of the temple, we have a lot of instability. And the Jews are really not reading the scriptures. At least that's what the prophets tell us. At least that's what we see in 2 Kings. But we do have this one very, very pious king, Yoshiyahu, in the 620s or 630s BCE, who tries to enact a reform. He says to the Judeans, look, you're not reading scripture. You're not observing the laws properly. Things are going to go badly for you. The Babylonians are going to get you. Well, I don't think he says that, but certainly the prophets living at this time, like Jeremiah, definitely do say that. And so Yoshiyahu tries to preempt a disaster, any divine retribution for these violations of scriptural law, by enacting a reform. And at the heart of this reform is Passover. But this Passover is associated with staying away from what are called in the text abominations of the Gentiles. So we really see at the very in the very earliest text about Passover, we see this association between Passover and anxiety about Gentiles. So look at verses 24. It's just verse 24 in source 1. Josiah, Yoshiyahu, did away with the mediums. That's all sorts of physical objects that were used to tell the future or to have some sort of prophecy, wizards, teraphim, idols, and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and Jerusalem. So abominations is a very strong word. So that he established the words of the law that were written in the book that the priest Hilkiah had found in the house of the Lord. So when Yoshiyahu, anybody know this story? When Yoshiyahu was cleaning out the first temple, he said, we have to start using the first temple properly. There are parts that haven't been cleaned out, that have been desecrated. We have to clean it out. And when he was cleaning it out, he finds what the text calls a Sefer Torah. Now, the rabbis say that this was Sefer Devarim, but we don't know for sure. It just says Torah. And in a passage of this Torah that he finds is a text that says, that tells us how to observe Passover. So I really should have started from the beginning of the source, but look at verses 21. The king commanded all the people, keep the Passover to the Lord your God as prescribed in this book. No such Passover has been kept since the days of the judges. So apparently people were not observing Passover for centuries. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was kept to the Lord in Jerusalem. So we have this association between we have to keep Passover and we have to stay away from the abominations of the Gentiles. Why is this important? Because I'm now going to show you Second Temple texts that show a real association between xenophobia, anxiety about strangers, and Passover. And this gets the Jews into trouble in the first century. So we're getting there. In 1907, on the island in the Nile River called Elephantine, a papyrus was discovered written by a Jew to another Jew about the holiday of Passover. This papyrus is dated to 419 BCE. You see it on your source sheet. But a little bit of, I want to give you a little bit of background about Elephantine. Elephantine, I know Avigal has heard me talk about this yesterday, but for the other two people in the room, do you know about Elephantine? Okay. Elephantine was, there are source sheets over there, was settled by the Persian military in the 5th century. The Persians had a garrison of Jews in their army. And this Jewish garrison settled Elephantine in the 5th century. And in the beginning of the 20th century, a cache of papyri written by the Jews who lived at Elephantine, I know, amazing, right? Was discovered. What's amazing about this is that we have basically no manuscripts from Jewish life under the Persians. We have almost nothing. We have texts, we have manuscripts from the medieval period that some scholars date to the Persian period, but an actual manuscript or a papyrus from that time, this was unheard of. This was such a boon. Now remember, the Persian period is only from 539 BC to 334 BC. It's not a big period. What happens in 334 BC? The Greeks, exactly. And from the time that Alexander the Great defeats the Persians, we have a ton of Jewish literature. For some reason, that Jewish literature circulated, was copied. A lot of it was preserved in the church, in the Catholic Church. But we don't have texts written by Jews in the Persian period. And then this was discovered. This cache of texts written by Jews who are working for the Persian military and living at Elephantine. One of the most amazing things about Elephantine, there are source sheets right in front of you, I think. one of the most amazing things is that they did not build a synagogue. They built a temple, a Jewish temple. Now, we all think, at least those of us who have had day school education, there was one temple. Right? In the first temple period, the prophets get very stressed out that people are building backyard altars called bamot, because the whole program of the first temple prophets is to streamline worship. All worship must be done in the Jerusalem temple. So many of us don't know and don't learn that in the second temple period, there was more than one Jewish temple. One of them was in a place called Leontopolis in Egypt, and one of them was at Elephantine. This means they were not using whatever the structure looked like to necessarily read the Torah, as Jews were already doing by then, at least in Babylonia. They were bringing animal sacrifices to the Jewish God. And so we have this papyrus. This is called the Passover papyrus. And this papyrus, one Jew, and it's interesting here because, again, this is a Jew living in the Persian world. He has a Jewish Hebrew name, is writing to another person. We have the green light this year to celebrate Passover. We don't have any papyri evidence that there's anything like this regarding Shavuot or Sukkot. Now, there was probably no concept of Purim at this time, or maybe there was among some Jews, but not everyone. There's obviously no concept of Hanukkah, because that's in 175 BC, right? But we have nothing like this except in regards to Passover. So let's try to understand what is compelling this person to say, good news, we have the green light to celebrate Passover. To my brethren, Yedanya, so God will judge, clearly not a Persian name, and his colleagues, I think that should be at the Jewish garrison, from your brother Hananya. This is unbelievable, objectively. The welfare of my brothers may God seek at all times. When you see that bracket, that means that there's a lacuna, that there's something unclear or perhaps a hole, or the papyrus was shredded so that you can't exactly make out the text. So that there's a little bit of scholarly speculation scholars are putting in their own. So if it says Jewish, maybe it's missing the yud, yud. Okay. This year, the fifth year of King Darius, so we have a date, which is also highly unusual in ancient manuscripts. We have a date. Word was sent from the king to Arsimus, that must have been a mid-level official, saying, authorize a festival of unleavened bread for the Jewish garrison. So count 14 days of the month of Nisan and observe the Passover. From the 15th to the 21st day of Nisan, observe the festival of unleavened bread. Be ritually clean and take... See, that's not a bracket. It's parentheses. That means that there's no word there. That's just the scholar explaining what kind of cleanliness. It doesn't mean take a bath. It means probably going to the mikvah. Do no work on the 15th or the 21st day. Do not drink beer. That was a common drink in ancient times. Nor eat anything in which there is leaven from the 14th at sundown until the 21st at Nisan. For 7 days it shall not be seen among you. Do not bring it into your dwellings, but seal it up between these dates by order of King Darius. Now, he could have just said, keep the Passover as it says in our scriptures, because he's basically quoting the scriptures here, right? But the key here is that they are to observe Passover in the Nile on this island called Elephantine by order of King Darius. This is one of the most fascinating, I think, fascinating texts dated to the Second Temple period that we have. Why would he say this? And I invite you to raise your hand or just say, what do you think here? By order of King Darius, what's happening here? Why do they need his permission?
It seems to be an order, not even permission, but more right. Like he's commanding them. Was he the son of Queen Esther?
The Midrash does say that, I think, there's another Midrash that Achashverosh and Esther gave birth to Darius, but there's also more than one Darius, so I'm not sure what that Midrash is about. But we really don't know a lot about, we don't know anything about Esther's lineage except what the Midrash tells us, and I'm not sure that we should read that as history, but that's for another discussion. But I think that there is some sort of anxiety here that we need permission from government officials to go ahead with this holiday. Now the question is why do they feel like they need permission? Could it be that there's some anxiety about celebrating Passover, which is associated with our separation from the foreign nations? Well, let's put that in the back burner. Yes?
Slaughtering the lamb, was that like something offensive to...
So in Egypt, slaughtering a lamb was extremely offensive because they treated the lamb like one of the animal gods. I don't think that is the case in Persian culture, but it's a very, very interesting suggestion. But look, you're dealing with a place with a temple where on a daily basis they're sacrificing animals. Right. Well, in order to understand how Passover was viewed in the Second Temple period, we have to look at the very, very most important Second Temple source on Passover, and that is the Book of Jubilees. For the Book of Jubilees, this is a 2nd century BCE text, Passover is the most important holiday in the Jewish calendar. Has anybody heard of the Book of Jubilees? Okay, great. The Book of Jubilees is a rewrite. I have to go back to the microphone. The Book of Jubilees is a rewriting of Genesis and the Exodus story. It ends with the people of Israel leaving Egypt. And this book was regarded as scriptural and authoritative. I'm not going to say canon because I don't know that there was a canon yet in the second century BCE. There definitely was an idea of the Torah, that is the Torah. But the Book of Jubilees was definitely regarded by some Jews as scriptural or authoritative in the Second Temple period. Why do I say that? Well, for one reason is that in the Dead Sea Caves at Qumran, we have 11 caves that contain about 900, hundreds and hundreds of fragments, 900 separate texts. Some of these texts overlap. In other words, there are many texts of Bereishit. There are many texts of Shemot. But so you're dealing with hundreds of texts. And of this, you have lots of texts that are now in our Tanakh. Many sectarian documents about how to live within the sect. Some books of biblical interpretation. And 15 copies of the Book of Jubilees. 15 copies. 15. Now, the Dead Sea Caves are also missing a book that is now in our Tanakh. Anybody know which book that is?
Esther.
Esther, right. So it's very possible that the community of Jews living at Qumran, assuming that they were the owners of this library that was found nearby, very likely viewed Jubilees, if not as canon, then as a book that had great religious value. And we also know that Jubilees was very early on copied and circulated into many languages. We have fragments of Jubilees in Ge'ez, in Ethiopic, in Syriac, in Aramaic. We have many different translations of Jubilees. That tells us Jubilees was a very highly circulated, very important book. But Jubilees is also a very strange book. The author advocates very strongly for separation from the foreign nations, circumcision, Shabbat, dietary law, the big three in ancient Judaism. So real separation, you have to adhere to ancestral law, and yet completely rejects a lunar Jewish calendar. The author of Jubilees thinks everyone is doing it wrong. We have to, excuse me, we have to observe a solar calendar. Now what this means is that you have someone who, in his mind, is an extremely pious Jew, anti-assimilation, anti-integration, and yet celebrates Yom Kippur on a different day than 99% of the Jews were celebrating on the Second Temple period. Celebrating Yom Kippur, that means he's eating food on everybody else's Yom Kippur. So Jubilees is a real conundrum for scholars. Was the author representing a broader community of Jews who were celebrating Yom Kippur on a different day? Or was he just a lone wolf, a lone person who had these very, very radical ideas that never caught on? We don't know. But we do know that this is a very popular book. So this is a question that remains unsolved in academic discussions. But for the author of Jubilees, Passover is absolutely foundational to Jewish piety. And for this author, Passover is absolutely tied into our rejection of all Gentile practice. And so he goes, this is the very end of the book. He goes on and on and on and on about Passover. Remember, Jubilees is a rewriting of Genesis and a rewriting of the Exodus story. So it makes sense that he would end with a discussion of Passover. The Jews left Egypt. They celebrated the first Passover. They sacrificed the Paschal lamb. And then Jubilees goes on and on and on with all this halachic legal information. And we're not going to read it all inside. But I want to point out a few texts. Are you with me in source 3? Okay. Oh, no, thank you. I'm just looking for the right verse. Okay. So look at verses 14 and 15. For this reason, the Lord commanded the children of Israel to observe the Passover on the day of its fixed time. They shall not break a bone thereof. For it is a festival day and a day commanded, and there be no passing over from day to day, month to month, on the day of its festival. Let it be observed. By the way, this suggests that maybe even in the second century BCE, Jews were not all celebrating Passover, at least not the way that this author envisions it. And it's all about the sacrifice. They shall not break a bone thereof. There's no Haggadah. There's not even necessarily a concept of Seder. So we're sacrificing the Paschal lamb and we're eating it in large family groups sometimes, or with other families. And command the children of Israel to observe the Passover throughout their days every year, once a year. And it shall come for a memorial, well-pleasing before the Lord. No plague shall come upon them to slay or to smite in that year in which they celebrate the Passover in its season in every respect. So first of all, like I said, this suggests that maybe Passover is not being celebrated in the proper way. And also, he really associates it with the wrongdoing of the Egyptians. And I'm trying to find that verse. Okay. All right. Well, I can't, but that's all right. For Jubilees, a highly particularistic text where he's emphasizing constantly not to integrate with other foreign people, Jubilees is the most important, besides maybe Yom Kippur, absolutely the most important holiday on the calendar. And it's associated with the event that culminates in the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. He goes on and on and on about the story of the Exodus. Now, some Jews were a little bit uncomfortable with this association. And Philo of Alexandria is one of them. I'm going to talk about him in a minute. But Philo interprets the entire holiday not in terms of its association with the Exodus story and the separation of Israel from the foreign nations. But Philo interprets the holiday metaphorically. Who is Philo? Philo was a first century CE Alexandrian, oh, I have to keep going to the mic, Alexandrian Jew, a great philosopher. He wrote a huge, huge, huge amount of texts interpreting the scripture. He was reading the Septuagint, the Greek Bible. He probably did not know Hebrew. He wrote philosophical treatises. He was circulating. He was hobnobbing in the most elite intellectual circles, and definitely very influenced by Stoic philosophy, definitely interacting with Greek philosophers. And Philo does something that was very common among philosophical schools in Alexandria. He was interpreting material texts allegorically. So let's look at what Philo does to Passover. Instead of associating it with this covenantal, exclusivist relationship with between Israel and God, Philo, let's look at source number 4 on page 3. Philo talks about matzah. Well, he goes on and on about Passover. I only gave you 2 paragraphs here. And he says, the Israelites, look at the underline, the Israelites baked their dough, which they brought out of Egypt, into buried unleavened cakes. That's the phrase. What does this mean? They needed the savage, untamed passion with aid of reason that softened it as though it were food. And the method by which they softened it, so this is the Israelites coming to some sort of intellectual maturity. The method by which they softened it and wrought it to something better was revealed to them by divine inspiration. And they did not utter it aloud, but treasured it in silence. Their hearts, the Israelites' hearts, were not lifted up by the revelation, but they were bowed in submission, and all proud thoughts were humbled. So he's talking about matzah here. And with every aspect of the Passover holiday, Philo works, and sometimes he does somersaults to make it work, to make Passover metaphorical and remove it from its historical context. So whereas Jubilees goes on and on and on about the story of the Exodus, we didn't read it, but you can scan it with your eyes, and really embedding the holiday in the covenantal relationship between Israel and God and the obligation that Israel has to God to carefully observe every mitzvah, Philo takes Passover out of its historical context and talks about the intellectual and philosophical maturity of the Israelites and how going from slavery out of Egypt to Sinai is akin to developing intellectual, like I said, intellectual, religious, spiritual maturity that was required in order to become an independent nation and leave their slave mentality. Any questions about Philo? Because I didn't really give much information about him, and I'm not sure if that's something that you're curious about. I'd love to, yeah.
Where would he fit within conventional views of Parshanut? Is he someone you could refer to? Is he someone who would be regarded as an outlier?
That's a great question. Philo, the rabbis don't know what to do with Philo. They do not cite him. Philo, like I said, was preserved. His writings were preserved by the Catholic Church. But in Philo's mind, he is a pious Jew. He over and over emphasizes the importance of ancestral law, of Shabbat, circumcision, dietary law, the big three. So Philo was, at least in a very fundamental way, commandment observant. I don't know that he knew all the ins and outs of Shemitah or whatever. He wouldn't have had to keep that anyway in Alexandria, but he does talk about adhering to his ancestral law. At the same time, he is highly reliant on Stoic philosophy, and he uses terminology from the Stoic schools that would have been very meaningful to Greek readers educated in the rhetorical schools. So he really is walking a tightrope of being a good Greek philosopher who's very integrated in those schools in Alexandria, and at the same time, not shying away from his Jewish identity. And one of his big programs is to argue that Judaism as a religion has integrity, and that the values that are at the heart of Judaism are consonant with the highest ideals of Greek life. So Moshe is not just somebody who took the Jews out, but he is the ideal philosopher. A lot of what you find in Philo, you later find in Maimonides. This effort to present Judaism as the greatest, most sophisticated philosophy, that rather than absorbing ideas from outside culture, it actually contributed to those major cultures. That's an idea that you do find in, like I said, in Maimonides. But Philo, he's not integrated into the rabbinic tradition. Sadly, I think. Yes?
Would he have done this just as a personal view, his interpretation of Pesach? Or did he do this more to placate the Egyptians that he was amongst?
I think that he definitely is motivated by the question, what will my non-Jewish readership think? He is highly conscious that non-Jews will be reading his text, and I think that over and over he tries to universalize Jewish practice so that it's taken out of its context if the context emphasizes the elect relationship between Israel and God. So over and over, Philo does make that effort to universalize. At the same time, he gets very annoyed by Jews who don't practice. So he says some people take this practice of this idea of allegory too far. They say, oh, I just have the idea of circumcision. I don't need to actually circumcise. Or I'll just take the idea of dietary law, whatever that is, and I won't actually keep kosher. Or I'll just have a Sabbath in my heart, but I won't actually keep Sabbath. And that drives Philo crazy. He says you have to keep the law, and you appreciate that the allegorical meaning is superior, but you have to keep the law. So apparently there were, at least what we know from Philo's writings, there were Jews in Alexandria who only read the Torah allegorically and rejected actual practice. And Philo says, no, we have to do the practice as well, which must have been very hard for him as somebody who presented himself as a member of the elite caste of intellectual life in Alexandria. So I want to end with Josephus. Josephus gives us two accounts of major uprisings that happen on Passover. And I want to suggest that Passover was a time of anxiety among Jews, because I think that they were a little bit concerned with how Passover looked to outsiders. I mean, here's a holiday where we're celebrating the suffering of the Egyptians, which was required in order for the Israelite slaves to be redeemed. And this idea that this culminates in a special relationship in which the Israelites are the chosen people and all the foreign nations are not the chosen people, I think that the Jews in the Second Temple period were highly conscious that this might not go over very well with some Greeks and later some Romans. And so this is a time of heightened tension. And things happen on Passover. Now, obviously, one text that's not on my source sheet, but we can all think about what happened in 32 CE on Passover when Jesus was crucified. I don't think that that's a coincidence. I think that Passover was a time of heightened tension and that Romans knew about Passover. And they didn't know all the ins and outs, but they knew details of what the holiday was commemorating, and that it highlighted for them, it underscored this idea that the Jews perceive themselves as being different from everybody else and also being special, being elect, being different. So I want to look at two accounts of tragedies that happened on Passover in the first century CE. The first century CE was rife with tension. The great war that occurred in 66 and that culminated in 70 with the destruction of the Second Temple, that was not out of a vacuum. It wasn't like one day the Jews in 66 said, you know what, this is the time that we're going to rebel against Rome. It feels like a good time to do that. And then the Romans came in and destroyed the Second Temple. That's kind of how I learned it in Beis Yaakov. But actually, the first century, really from the time that Judea is a Roman province, it becomes a Roman province, and that's in 6 CE. Really from that time on, the Jews are very unhappy. And for good reason, the prefects, the Roman prefects who were given jurisdiction over Judea were at best extremely unkind to the Jews. Taxation was out of control. And the Jews felt very harassed by non-Jewish neighbors. And Josephus talks about some of the things that non-Jews would do, and then the Romans wouldn't intervene. There is one account that Josephus talks about where in the Galilee, outside a synagogue on Saturday morning, a non-Jew took a pot, he turned it upside down, he grabbed a bird, and he started slaughtering it on the pot, on the upside down pot, outside the synagogue. And he said, I'm at the temple, I'm at the temple. And he's mocking the Jews. And the Jews complained to their local Roman prefect, and he said, what am I going to do about it? And then the Jews came back with some more people, and they said, look, it was a bigger crowd of Jews. They said we feel harassed by our Roman, by our Gentile neighbors. And the second time that the Jews approached him, these Jews were arrested. So, and later they were released. But there's high tension at this time. It's not a stable situation at all. Just so you have a mental timeline. So we talked about the Assyrians, right? And then the Babylonians in the 6th and 5th century. And then 539, well, in the 6th century. In 539, the Persians destroyed the Babylonians. In 334, the Greeks destroyed the Persians. And Rome really comes to the fore in 63 BCE, just so you have the mental timeline. And in 63 BCE, Judea becomes a client monarchy of Rome, so they're paying a certain amount of money annually to Rome. But in 6 CE, that's when Rome really incorporates Judea into the Roman Empire. Okay, so let's look at Josephus. Josephus is living at the end of the first century. He was very personally involved in the Roman War. He headed a garrison of troops in the Galilee. And he came from a very, apparently, very elite priestly family in Jerusalem. So he was given as a young man this garrison of troops, but he really was not a military man. He was an intellectual. And his garrison, Josephus's time as a general was disastrous, and all of the Jews in his garrison were killed by the Romans. So Josephus defected. He defected to Rome, and he was he was captured by Vespasian. And he was taken to Rome, and that's where he lived out his days. He was released by Vespasian, and Josephus tells us he was treated very well. I think that he probably had to say that because his works were commissioned by the Flavian family. The Flavian dynasty is Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian at the end of the first century. So we don't really know exactly what Josephus' experiences were because he's very careful to not make his Roman adopted family, so to speak, unhappy. So he is always walking that tightrope of being a proud representative of the Jewish religion and yet being very careful about what he says about Rome. So let's see how much time we have to do these sources. Now, the first source is in a book called The Jewish War. And this is a retelling of the war from 66 to 70. Josephus gives a lot of reasons for what led to this great rebellion that ended in disaster for the Jews. But what's interesting is that he starts the Jewish War in the time of Herod. Now, Herod was, look at the date, 4 BCE. Herod dies, I think, in 6 CE. So why does Josephus start his account of the Jewish War by talking about the Herodian family? If you know anything about Herod, you might be able to guess.
Didn't he purport to be Jewish?
Well, his father was an Idumean convert. So he was Jewish. The Jews never accepted him because they thought that his conversion was insincere and that he just did it for political gain. And of course, he was careful to marry women who were in the Hasmonean dynasty, like Miriam, Mariamne in Greek, and he killed her. Like many people were killed by Herod. He killed Mariamne's little brother, who was 17. He drowned him, Aristobulus. Herod was crazy, and I don't mean that even hyperbolically. Scholars now think that he was a paranoid schizophrenic. He would go on a killing rampage, and then or perhaps bipolar. He would go on a rampage of killing, and then he would, this is one interpretation that I've heard that I find very compelling. Then he would go on a building spree. You know, Herod was a great builder, right? He built up Masada as a great fortress. He built Herodium, another fortress. He built a palace. He built many great estates and buildings in Jerusalem. He renovated the temple. So one way that I've heard it, and take it or leave it, is that he would kill and kill and kill, and then he would be overwhelmed with a great depression, and then he would build and build and build and build, and then he would feel okay, and then he would kill, and then he would go into, but maybe not. I mean, we don't exactly know what the relationship is, but he would go into these manic states of, I'm gonna build like crazy, and then, but he killed hundreds of people. And he basically wiped out the Hasmonean dynasty. The rabbis tell us that he preserved Miriam in honey. Have you heard this? Because she was so beautiful and he loved her so much. And Josephus says he loved her so much, but he was just sure that she was trying to kill him. And he accused her of being unfaithful. So that's Herod. So the Pharisees, the proto-rabbis, the Jews who were to become the inheritors or the transmitters of the oral tradition really, really hated Herod. And so what happens in 4 BCE? Herod has just killed a couple hundred Jews, doctors, Josephus says. But I think that he means intellectuals here. I have to go back to the Jewish war and look this up. He killed a couple hundred Jews. And now the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So according to my argument, this is a very tense time of the year, which the Jews call Passover, came around. It is an occasion for the contribution of a multitude of sacrifices. Remember, there's no Seder yet, or there might be a Seder where you eat the Paschal lamb, but there's no Haggadah. So the crux of the holiday focuses on the sacrifice, and a vast crowd streamed in from the country for the ceremony. So people are streaming into Jerusalem. The promoters of the mourning for the doctors stood in a body in the temple, procuring recruits for their faction. This is a very hard sentence, but what is Josephus saying? That there were Jews who were so angry that Herod had just killed a couple hundred of what he calls doctors or intellectuals, that these Jews are gathering a group of rebels in the temple on Passover. That there are a couple hundred Jews now getting ready to go on the attack, thank you for closing the door, and fight against Herod, their own king. This alarmed Archelaus, that's Herod's son, who, wishing to prevent the contagion from spreading to the whole crowd, sent in a tribune, that's a Roman tribune, a Roman officer. The Herods were friends of the Romans. That's also a major reason why the Jews did not like him. Did I say the Herods? The Herodian family. Sent in a tribune in command of a cohort. So basically Archelaus, Herod's son, sends in 30 or 40 Roman troops to stop these Jews from doing harm to the Herodian family. He sends in a tribune in command of a cohort with orders to restrain by force the ringleaders of the sedition. Indignant at the appearance of the troop, the whole crowd pelted them with stones. Most of the cohort, the Roman cohort, were killed, while their commander was wounded and escaped with difficulty. This is in the year, again, 4 BCE, on Passover, the crowd is so riled up, not at the Romans, but at the Herodian family for betraying their own people and killing them when they don't show total fealty. Then, as if nothing serious had happened, the rioters returned to their sacrifices. Archelaus, however, now felt it would be impossible to restrain the mob without bloodshed, and he let loose upon them his entire army. So basically, we have this mini war on Passover. The soldiers, oh wait, I skipped a line. Okay, so there's basically this big mass killing. The infantry advances against the city. Now look at the last sentence. The heralds of Archelaus followed and ordered everyone to return home, so they all abandoned the festival and departed. Why do the rebels against Herod and against his son Archelaus choose Passover as the time to gather all these people and rebel? There's something about Passover that reflects this heightened anxiety, this heightened effort to be very clear that we are the elect people of God. And yes, we know you Romans do not like that you regard us as insular. And these were the things that were circulating about the Jews at this time, that the Jews do not participate in public life. Remember, in Rome, public life and religion were one and the same. It was the same thing. So if you did not participate in public life, you were also rejecting the religion, the official religion of Rome. If you were not going to bring a sacrifice every year to the temple of Jupiter, to Jupiter at his temple, then you were a bad Roman. You were turning against the emperor himself. And by the way, starting with Octavian/Augustus, the emperors themselves claimed divinity. So to say we only have this one true God, he chose us, we're special, nobody else is the elect people of God, and we are only going to be loyal to him, you're rejecting the official religio, the official religion of Rome. You're rejecting the emperor himself. It's complete treason. And so we can see why Passover was a time of heightened anxiety. I don't want to do the next 10:15. I don't want to do the next source. But I just want to say, and this is the most important part of this talk, the Haggadah completely undermines this idea. The Haggadah universalizes Passover in a very innovative way that we do not see in Second Temple sources. I have to go back to the mic. I'm sorry. If you think about what is in the Haggadah, and of course, it's assembled over centuries. But as it stands now, this idea that we're inviting anyone to come eat with us, right? Anyone who needs a meal is going to come to us. It doesn't say any Jew, right? We take wine out of our cups to memorialize the suffering of the Egyptians. So we empathize with the other. We do focus on the Egyptian and the story of the Egyptians and our Exodus, but really we focus on the suffering of the Jewish people and of God's redemption of the Jewish people. There's very little about those mean, terrible Egyptians. So I think that what the Haggadah achieves is really remarkable, and it really shifted the way that the Jews thought about Passover and celebrated Passover in a very, very remarkable way. And I think that was a major achievement on the part of the rabbinic community. All right, any questions?
Why Darius? What happened with Darius?
Oh, you mean why did he allow for religious freedom? Oh, okay. So yeah, this is a great question. So I think that the Jews felt that they needed formal permission to celebrate Passover in 419 because they were employees of the Persian army. They were employees of the government. These Jews at Elephantine were working for the Persian military, and I think that they felt that Passover is a little bit of a loaded holiday. We want to make sure that we have the official green light before we start celebrating this holiday. There's anxiety about Passover. We don't have any papyrus that says, oh, we have permission to celebrate Rosh Hashanah. We have permission to celebrate Shavuot. There's something about Passover that gives rise to anxiety. Yes?
Can it be that even without the Haggadah, the whole story is the story of a small nation who becomes free from like a huge, powerful oppressor? So that's like, I mean, Jews were always under someone's boots. So
right.
It's kind of, whenever they celebrated, it's kind of like saying, well, one day we're going to be free.
Right. And I think that you could definitely look at that angle, but I'm not sure that that in the Second Temple period, it was sort of this generic positive angle. I think that there was this emphasis, you see it so much in Jubilees, of this is the story of how Israel was chosen by God and separated from the nations. Yes. And then I have to let them in. Yeah.
I'm not sure I agree with your point, or I think your point about Haggadah not being, or the Haggadah trying to make Pesach more universalistic, because we have Shvoch HaMatcha, which is a very
oh yeah, absolutely. And that's a later text.
And you know, over the centuries,
right,
as you were saying,
right,
Pesach and Feast of Pesach have historically continued.
Absolutely.
Right now I'm down to the time of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, but century after century.
Oh yeah. Passover was a terrible time for the Jewish people.
Right.
Libel. There is that thread following through. Okay. We'll talk about Heather and Holly.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, we'll get started. I apologize for the small delay.